Yeah, and so that's a big, brave conversation. You're going to open me up on that. And I heard you say bowel cancer. You know, like we've got a national bowel cancer screening program. How the hell did we get to that? In 2006, we gave advice to the Ministry of Health that if you want to do cancer and you want to do equity, you'll do lung cancer. That's where you'll start. If you want to do equity and you want to do cancer, you'll do cervical cancer. That's where we've got to get it done. And so that our biggest contribution to health gain for the country in terms of equity will come from lung cancer and cervical cancer and breast cancer.
And welcome to The C Word. I'm your host, Helen King. If you like what you hear today, please subscribe to the show on iTunes or follow us on Spotify. Today's episode is a continuation from the conversations I've been having leading up to the election around some of the issues facing our health system. It's been especially important to flesh out some of these issues, I think, because we're being asked to decide on two referendum at the same time as voting in a new government. And I don't know about anyone else, but I kind of feel like choosing a new government seems a lot easier than making a decision around either the end of life choice bill or the cannabis bill. I've been grappling with this stuff for a few weeks because I feel like it is such an important decision and we need to make sure that we're making the most informed decision we can. And I kind of wish that they had separated the referendum from the elections. That would, in my mind, help people focus on what has been asked rather than these issues becoming political footballs or getting lost in all the coverage around COVID. I've been thinking about inequity in our health system a lot, and as we've been doing the show and interviewing different people, one of the things that just keeps coming up again and again when we look at outcomes for different types of cancers is how badly our Māori population do compared to Pākehā. So to discuss this enormous issue, I contacted my guest for today to ask if he would come on and talk to me about decolonisation and equality in healthcare. You know, like really easy topics for a podcast. But thankfully, Dr. Rawiri McCree-Jansen, who is a GP in Papakura in South Auckland, agreed to come on and have this conversation with me. He has spoken a lot about reforms needed in our health system, and so I felt like he was the perfect person to have this conversation with. And I quickly realised as we started talking that I'd made the same mistake as so many Pākehā people do by asking a Māori person to tell me what the Māori perspective is. Rawiri kindly reminded me that there's no such thing as the Māori perspective, just the same as there isn't a Pākehā perspective. And once we had cleared that up, we started talking about whether our health system is the right place for decisions to be made around end-of-life choice.
So as we go into thinking about euthanasia, for me, there's a number of issues. I'll start at the end, though, just to tell you, I won't be voting in favour of end-of-life choice. Yeah. And so there's a number of contributing things to that. And stop me when you've heard enough, but there'd be, for me, one of them is, why would you choose doctors to make that decision? We, you know, we've got a track record. We've got history. We've got baggage. Yeah. We deliver inequitable health outcomes. You know, it's not all on us, but when you look at health services and when you look at the contribution that doctors make, it isn't equitable. And so if you wanted to work a way through having something where people were allowed to choose to kill themselves, end their life, then why wouldn't you choose family court? That's a place where decisions are made about people's lives and how those things are organised and certain permissions and authorisations around that. And so at least as a thought experiment, there are other classes of professionals who might be better at helping people through those complex conversations. There's another part of me goes, I'm deeply worried that the end-of-life choice won't be choice. So this came up in the Y2575, in the Waitangi Tribunal claim, and one of the panel was Professor Linda Tuhiwai-Smith, and she was just asking some people about the health system, and this one witness had used the term choice, and she said, but is that real choice? Are people actually in a position to make real choices about those things, or is choice a sort of academic configuration of options, but in reality, do you have a choice of who is your primary care provider? And in some communities, there isn't a choice. There's a single provider, or there's a provider that costs $47 per visit, and there's a provider that costs $18 per visit. So it isn't choice in the sense that people often promote it. And I think the same will be true in end of life. If this kind of bill goes forward, we would end up with people apparently having choice and it isn't choice. I'd much rather that we did a whole lot of work in supporting people through palliative care and making sure that we had a really fantastic palliative care system, that it was well-funded and that it had good reach into communities, that it was culturally concordant. You know, that it was, I think about a lot of Māori whānau and a lot of my patients would choose to die at home.
Yeah.
And sometimes that isn't a real choice because we don't have the support systems, we don't have the resources, we don't know how to wrap our services around this whānau. This whānau would like to do these parts of the care and somebody else come in and do these other parts, and it can all work absolutely beautifully. Mm. Now, let's make sure that our health system's organised to give those choices to whānau. I think that's just way more important. At the end of it all, I think people, you know, they can manage their end of life, and I want to give them the tools and the resources and the support to do that. But that's a really complex thing to think about as a healthcare professional. I've made a commitment. I've got a vow. I've got an oath that says I'm going to protect life and do stuff like that, and I want to do that really, really well. I want to focus on being the best I can be at that. And you know, we've got this other conversation about suicide and youth suicide, and I think this is an impossibly difficult conversation to be having. That says, "Yep, these people, you've got the you've got the right to die, and these people over here, no, definitely don't do dying. Dying's bad." And you know, so for me, I'm trying to simplify my life, I guess. Sorry about it, but I'm thinking about, how do we have really fantastic conversations with our young people, make sure that they're safe and supported and resourced and they've got a vision for their life and all of those things? And equally, I want to be that kind of influence with people who are dealing with end of life and palliative care and their cancer journeys. I just want to be the best that I can be to support them and resource them and be there for them. So for me, at the end of all of those kind of conversations, and I could go on, but I'm just saying I'm not going to vote for it. I don't want to see it.
I'm on the cusp. And I've said this to, you know, each person I've interviewed, is that for me, the thought of my cancer coming back and dying slowly scares me. And there is part of me that would like the choice of how that happens, of how, you know, how I choose to go. But at the same time, I don't trust our health system to provide for everyone, because I had a very privileged experience with my cancer care. I was very lucky, and I can advocate for myself. And at times I had to, because as you probably know, some of your esteemed colleagues can be think that they, you know, they know best when actually they need to, you know, be listening. So there are all of those things in consideration. But also the other thing that you pointed to that I think is grossly imbalanced is our palliative care and who has access to it. I think it's quite a complex one. And I guess it's because this lead up to this election has been so bizarre. And then to put these two questions of do you support end of life bill and do you support the legalization of cannabis, it's that's quite a lot in you know, one polling booth to be deciding upon, I think.
Yep, I agree with that. and so democracy's got some real faults and some real challenges, and we haven't got a better system. That's the thing, you know, like it beats being in America, it beats being in Russia, it beats being in China. So it's a faulty system, but I haven't got a better plan yet.
No, no.
And, you know, like cannabis, I'm going, it's really, really challenging for me because I really want it legalised. I really want it decriminalised. I've just seen so much harm for generations of young Māori men who've been arrested. It's been the discrimination in our law enforcement and in our justice system has been just, you know, generational damage.
Yes.
Just, you know, young men, just so many of them have been, Māori men, have been picked up. I was at some conference and this guy was talking about, he said something like 40% of Māori men in prison have a conviction for cannabis. And that may not be the primary reason why they're in jail, but the truth is our system works and it says if you have other convictions, then the consequences will be greater. And, you know, just the consequential layering of all of this on top of people having, you know, access to dope. Yeah. And, you know, we're selling plenty of alcohol. We've got huge alcohol harms, but the differentiation will be one is treated this way and the other one is treated another way. And I just get so unhelpful.
Yeah.
And why are we doing a referendum on this? I'm going, where's the leadership to do the right thing? You know, like the chief science advisor, if you want to go somewhere to read about the cannabis referendum, go to the website of the chief science advisor. There must be 100 questions there, and every question's got an answer that's got 10 references, articles published. What's the evidence? Oh, man, it is so good.
Yeah.
And yet we're going to go to a vote in which, you know, differentially some people won't vote.
No.
You know, some people, their vote will be worth than more than other people. It's messing with my head.
Yeah, and I feel like they both kind of mess with my head a bit. And the cannabis one, I don't, you know, think that I'll access it all of a sudden because it's legal. But I see the impact it has on another part of my community. And there's part of me that thinks, well, you know, legalising it would help this part of my community. And perhaps I have a duty to, you know, to make that easier or to take away that, you know, one of the barriers.
I mean, when meth first came out, it wasn't called P or something like that. And I remember this patient came to see me and he was, I had a clinic at the time in K Road. So I had 23 methadone patients.
Oh, yeah.
You know, people were getting off the morphine, heroin, the opiate stuff. Yeah. And that's a big load. And I had homeless people and I had prostitutes and, you know, it's a very interesting community. Well, back in the day, it's gentrifying now. At K Road, you get a nice apartment there. But back in the day, it was a really interesting community. I had one millionaire. But anyway, so this guy comes in and he was a methadone patient and he wanted his methadone stuff and then he wanted to talk to me about his daughter. He's really worried about his daughter. She's smoking that pee. Oh, that fucking pee is so bad. It's like terrible, man. It's one taste and you're hooked for life, you know? And I'm going, well, I don't know, you know, I'm not sure. I'm just, you know, but I tell you what, that sounds exactly like what we used to say about heroin.
Yeah.
One taste and you're hooked for life. And it kind of closed him down a bit, but I'm trying to get him to think through and reflect because we've got a tendency to catastrophize this stuff. You know, it's like this drug scourge, it's the worst thing ever. Well, it turns out that people who were exposed to opiates, about 3% of them you know, got into real difficulty with it. And it's probably true with alcohol, probably something, I don't know, might be 3 or 5% of people get in real trouble with it.
Yep.
And it's probably true of marijuana, it might be 3% of people get in trouble with it. And okay, so P might be somewhat different, and maybe it's 8 or 10% of people get in trouble with it, but catastrophizing doesn't get us to a better place. Let's be able to talk about these issues and what's going on and how we help people. You know, 20 years later, I've got lots of patients and lots of families who have got through. The meth addiction has been dealt with. You know, it's not impossible. Yes, it's hard, but how do we support our communities and our families and individuals who are struggling with that stuff? How do we get them through? That's our job. You know, that's as a community, as a nation, that's a much better place than just blowing it up and acting all like this is the worst thing ever.
I find that really interesting because I went undiagnosed for, you know, 39.5 years of my life of, because I have ADHD. And so partly hyperactive, partly inattentive. And so a big part of it for me was about the risk taking and the, you know, I was a very heavy drinker, and then I accessed treatment, and things got a lot better. And so when I look at, I guess, my perspective of drug addiction, and, you know, I've watched P unfold and the sort of hysteria, and I go back to kind of what I know is it's not actually about the substance. It doesn't matter what that substance is. It's the underlying things. And I think it is so much easier for us to go, it's P's problem. Oh, no, if we legalise cannabis, we're going to have this sort of outbreak of people addicted to it and things. And I sort of think that's not actually how addiction works. And you must have seen it in your practice over the decades that just because something's available does not actually mean that a whole lot of people are going to become addicted to it.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
So it's really important for us to think about that and hold that and, I guess, hold each other as we go through some real interesting challenges. And we get through this if we can be together, you know, and respond to what are the needs and what are people going through. And yeah, so those are challenges. But in the end, next minute you've got an election. Next minute you've got 2 referenda. So
it's crazy. And I guess this sort of brings me back to the first thing a month or so ago when I was thinking about, our health system and some of the things that aren't so great about it. And when you sent me the video of your talk to the medical students, I'm guessing. And talking about I guess inequality and racism in the health system, and what does decolonization or decolonizing our health system look like? And I was very intrigued by that because we spoke with one of our previous guests we spoke to about this because after his sister passed away from cervical cancer, he and his family have kind of carried along her charity work, Smear Your Mayor, who do quite amazing work. Yeah, they do amazing work. But from listening to, you know, that experience and listening to your talk, sort of starting to get that idea that actually the way we've been doing things for, you know, since white folks arrived on the shore hasn't really been working. How do we make those steps to even consider a different possibility?
Yeah, and so that's a big, brave conversation. You're going to open me up on that. And I heard you say bowel cancer. You know, like, we've got a national bowel cancer screening program. How the hell did we get to that? In 2006, we gave advice to the Ministry of Health that if you want to do cancer and you want to do equity, you'll do lung cancer. That's where you'll start. If you want to do equity and you want to do cancer, you'll do cervical cancer. That's where we've got to get it done. And so that our biggest contribution to health gain for the country in terms of equity will come from lung cancer and cervical cancer and breast cancer. Bowel cancer ain't in the list. You're doing bowel cancer because that gets you elected. I see you. I see you, government that has proposed a bowel cancer screening program. I see you. You ain't doing that for equity. You got a big policy called equity, but you ain't doing it. You're doing something else. You're doing something called, I need to get elected. I'm going to reach out to the biggest population that gets me elected. So the hard conversation that we've got to have as a nation is we've got to park that shit and go, what do we really want? What are we really committed to? Because at the moment we say it's equity, but actually we do inequity. We did a national bowel cancer screening program that will deliver more saved lives, Pākehā, than saved lives Māori. At the end of rolling out a brilliant program that saves lives, we will have saved a whole lot more Pākehā lives than Māori lives. Is that what we intended? That's not the smartest thing to do, and it's not what we said we'd do. And I get all riled up about it. I've bloody been going at them, man, and I'm calling them out and going, you know, stop doing this. And so with the bowel cancer program, we've got one way of essentially getting it to equity neutral. And that is to get the age differentiation right. Here's the hard truth. I'll make it hard for you. What we should do is we should stop Pākehās having bowel cancer screening until they're 67. We shouldn't be starting at age 60. Mm. We've got to hold you back until age 67. Mm. And then we'll get the same equity, we'll get the same gain from bowel cancer screening. We'll save this amount of Pākehā lives and we'll save the same amount, relatively, the same amount of Māori lives. Or we could do it, if you want to save more lives, you've got to spend a bit more money, then you need to start screening Māori at age 50. The evidence is very, very clear. If you start at age 60, you're going to miss nearly half of all Māori bowel cancers. That's not a national screening program. That's a fucking disgrace. Don't be doing that. You know, if you did that, you did that because you knew who's going to elect you, not because you prepared to do the right thing. And, you know, this is a hard thing for the governments. This is a hard thing for the ministry. But, you know, get a backbone in this. Get a backbone. Get this job done. But we've got to have equity in this country. We can't. It is not our future. You know, I understand that it was our past. That was it. We can't change the past, but we better own the past. We better learn from the past. We better get busy on a different future. So when you talk about decolonizing our health systems, hey, yeah, we want to own what the future looks like. We want to have a future where we've got health equity for Māori. We want to have a future in 2040 where we go, yes, we want to celebrate the signing of the Treaty of Waitangi 200 years ago. Well, we got some work to do. Man, we've got some work to do. I'll tell you that.
Yeah, and I mean, hopefully our listeners have been listening to, you know, all of our episodes, but I had no idea the horrific stats we have around our gynae cancers. I know, for instance, for ovarian cancer, our outcomes have not changed since the 70s, and there has been no investment in gynecological cancers from this government, which, when you know what the rates are and when you know that these things, if they're caught early, often have an okay outcome. But then when you dig a little bit deeper and you look at who the highest rates of deaths are, then it's painting the picture that when no one is talking about. And with in lung cancer as well, I mean, lung cancer is not a very marketable cancer at all. Which sounds highly cynical, but I know for me, like having breast cancer, the breast cancer, charities have been able to do a pretty good marketing job about raising funds and, you know, the pinkifying of it and those sorts of things. But I think lung cancer just doesn't get that same thing. But also when you look at who it impacts the most, then, you know, those pictures start to become clearer and clearer.
Yep. Marketing, it's troublesome, isn't it? Because we get really judgmental. We can go, oh, well, these people brought it on themselves. You know, and it's such an easy thing to think, and I think people get marinated in that version of stuff. And really, are people making a choice? That's how we end up with bullshit about, our housing crisis. No, I haven't met anybody who wants to live in a garage.
No.
No. Garage only became a good thing to live in when yeah. other people were living in a car.
And it then became.
How did we get to this place? How did we get there? That it's somebody goes, yeah, well, at least I've got a garage. You know, it's fucked up. How did we get there that we created a situation in housing where people are living in cars? Yeah. That's insane. We got to stop that shit. We got to say, as a society, it's really important that we build houses and we house people. And, you know, here's the craziest thing of it. We've been there before. We've been there before.
Yeah.
You know, let's learn that lesson. Let's lock that one in. We are better as a country when we make sure that the neediest get their needs met, when the most vulnerable get protection, they get safety. And we just got to start with something that says warm, dry, safe. Mm. We've got to have families in houses. Mm. You know, basic is that. And then when you do that, you get these huge changes in their health status and in their ability to control their lives. Mm. You know, so we talked about sort of alcohol and other drug addictions, mm. and we're adding in cigarette smoking. Now, if we go in the wrong track here, we end up with this blame game, this blame narrative, this judgmental narrative, and we want to get out of that. We've got to decolonize that thinking and go, actually, as a community, as a society, we're responsible for making the resources available for people to be able to live good lives.
Mm.
You know, people need sick leave. People got to have a living wage. People got to have a house.
Mm.
That's what we've got to do.
Yeah. I don't think people do. Yeah. I mean, people don't understand that at all. And there is that blame game. I feel, you know, with breast cancer, when you've had cancer, there is always this little bit of how did I cause this? And I kind of think, you know, what you said before of no one asks for cancer or, you know, these diseases. And it's actually a really, you know, it is a brutal, nasty disease to have. And shaming people has never been the best way of, you know, amplifying good health. It is an uncomfortable place to sit, of acknowledging what your privilege is in a society. And I certainly know for me that, you know, I got diagnosed and had surgery within 2 weeks. You know, it happened very, very quickly and I was really lucky. But I think it's hard for people to sort of start thinking about what if the health system wasn't friendly to you? What if every time you went to the doctor, they were really rude or didn't believe what you were saying or didn't believe that you were in pain or, yeah, told you that it was your fault that you have X, Y, Z. And so trying to change those perspectives, and I don't know whether that's where you do it when you're, you know, trying to change and push for, you know, a more equitable health system, of understanding that the reason Pacifica women or Māori women are diagnosed with breast cancer later is because they don't present as early as Pākehā women, and there are reasons for that. There are hurdles in the way of that process that need to be acknowledged and sort of dealt with, I guess. Yeah.
Yep. And okay, so one way of thinking about this is I go to a cohort where people don't get judgmental. Mm. Yeah, because we all love babies, right? Babies are, you know, because they're not to blame for anything. So, you know, if babies need stuff, then there's a good, I can mount a really good argument. I can market this idea. These are babies. They are innocent and we should be doing the right thing. So we've got a system at the moment which is starting to ask our whole system how to work together to get better outcomes. It's called system level measures. Mm. It's not just a simple thing that you measure one person did. Nurses did this, therefore our system's better off, or doctors did this, or hospitals did this. We've been there. Those simple targets are not the right targets. We want to get more complex targets, so they're called system level measures. Mm. Okay. Imagine that we had a fantasy that said we want all babies living in smoke-free homes. Beautiful. I love it. We got to get busy back in that housing space again, because can you imagine how hard it is to be living in a smoke-free home when you're living with two other families? There's 15 people in a three-bedroom house. Mm. You don't have power. You don't have control over your life to go, I'm pregnant, I've got a baby, I need to be in a smoke-free home. You don't have that. What you have is you're damn lucky to be in a house, three-bedroom house, 15 people. Oh, man. So I love the idea of smoke-free homes for babies. That's a beautiful plan. But you know what? If we're going to do that, man, we've got some work to do.
Yeah. It's funny, isn't it? I had this conversation recently. It's in training I did, and it's slightly different area of the health system, but talking about mental health. And it was really interesting because there was about, I don't know, half a dozen of us. Some work within the mental health field. Others had been mental health consumers. And not one person said part of my wellness strategy is to engage with the mental health system. Yeah. All of it was you know, connection, community, self, you know, having that self-care. If you have got a spirituality, having that connection. But not one person said, oh, yeah, calling the crisis team when I feel bad. You know, it just...
And not one of them said, I want an extended consult with my GP. Not one of them said, oh, I want a nurse who's trained in mental health stuff. Not one of them said, I want a psychologist free appointment. No. But our wellness is going to be about how we live and who we live with and the communities we live in. Mm. That's the place we've got to invest. I'm with you. I'm totally with you.
And it's coming back to me now that that stuff that you're talking about in your presentation is, yeah, actually stepping away from the system itself and saying, what do we actually need to do to prevent people from getting to this point? And I feel like a lot of politics and you know, that sort of system stuff is very much ambulance at the bottom of the cliff. And I sort of think if we don't want to have, you know, high suicides or high levels of addiction or asthma or, you know, anything, it's going right back and thinking about, are we providing the basics of life? And I suspect in many cases the answer is no, we are not. So how can you expect to reduce levels of anything if we don't have you know, if we cannot thrive in the places that we're living?
Yep. And so good suicide prevention is actually about community development strategies. It's about education and employment opportunities. And if we do those things well, that will contribute, you know, hugely. So and that decolonizing thing that you're kind of provoking me to talk about is to go, let's go upstream. Let's shift left. Let's go upstream and figure this one out. So if we want to deal to lung cancer, sure, let's screen and find lung cancers and treat them. But let's go upstream. Let's help people to give up. Let's go upstream and keep people safe from cigarettes. Let's go upstream and get into smoke-free homes. Let's go that place, because that's the place we're going to get really great benefits.
Because like, I always think back to my treatment for cancer, and I had one night in hospital when I was on chemo because my temperature spiked, and I was in the oncology unit. We didn't have any beds, so I was upstairs in the fancy unit. I think it's the air pressured one. I can't think what it's called. But there were a few of us in there, and there was a Māori woman who was maybe a year or two older than me. She had the exact same breast cancer as I had. Sounds like we were diagnosed around the same time. And we were talking, and there'd been a history of breast cancer. She knew what it was and everything. So she had her mastectomy, and she'd been too scared to have the chemo. And then it spread. And I just remember thinking, fuck, you know, like, who was, like, How did they present this information to you to be so frightened of a hopefully life-saving treatment? And I kind of got a, I guess I had an inkling of what had probably gone on, because the reason she was in hospital that day was because she hadn't taken the meds that you take so you don't have a reaction to your chemo. So, it was heartbreaking. She had children. And it just, in that moment, I just sort of, there was a very good example to me of the privilege of being a white woman going through the health system as a, versus a Māori woman with the exact same diagnosis.
And so we do have to fix the health system as well. You know, the provocation in that story is about thinking about how did we organise our offer, how do we organise our system to meet her needs? Did we discover that she was scared? Did we know what's going on in her life that would help her to be able to get to the right place? Was it we didn't take enough time to talk through? We didn't take enough time to listen? Was it that we didn't take enough time to understand the complexities of her life? You know, because when you think about the health system, you don't immediately think, man, they're good at listening. Oh, man, they listen so good.
No.
You know, they really listen.
I'm sorry, you doctors are not known for listening.
Not known for it, eh? We're way more likely to go, look, here's the treatment plan. You've got to do this and this and this and this, okay? That's the plan. We've got to do this, and I need you to agree to that right now.
Yeah.
And the truth is that if it was truly a right now decision, I didn't ask you. If it was an emergency, I didn't seek permission. Mm-hmm. I didn't have informed consent. I just got shit done. It was an emergency. So anything else has a time frame, which the patient's entitled, in my view, the patient's entitled to ask, okay, how long do I have to make that decision? You know, and I think of lots of Māori patients who would go, okay, honestly, I've only got 48 hours to make that decision. Okay, I know who I need to speak to. There's one person I need to speak to, or something like that. And somebody, if it was, I've got a month. You know, this treatment plan can wait a month. Then that's a different. I know I need to talk to some people. I'm thinking about this. I'm thinking about that. Maybe okay, look, I'll come back to you in 3 weeks. I've got some questions. You know, how is it that we actually allow that time and space for people to make good decisions? Because if we do a dumb shit thing like saying you have to decide right now, I know that's not true. I know that's not true. We've got to do a better job than that. And, I mean, my own experience, I had an older Māori woman, and she had decided not to go for her chemo. And it took ages to try and figure it out. And the how we actually figured it out was she came to consult with her daughter.
Yeah.
And her daughter was saying that she wanted her to have the chemo. And we sort of, okay, well, you know, it's mum's decision. Let's just check in with mum. And actually what mum was struggling with was how to get there. We were living out in South Auckland in this suburb that literally would take you an hour and a quarter to get to the place where you have the chemo. And what we had to solve actually was that her daughter's children, once we got that sorted, once we had the childcare arrangements in place, the daughter could take mum in for the chemo. Boom, never missed an appointment. What the mum was really saying was, I don't know how to privilege my need for chemo over the needs of this family and these mokopuna that I love. What do I just go, like, everybody just do shit so that I have to go for my... She couldn't have that conversation, but we found a way of being able to find out what the problem was, and we discovered what the solution was, and she was in. She never missed an appointment. And the daughter was feeling, like, totally empowered by it because she wanted this as well.
Yeah.
You know, discover the problem, find a solution. You know, that's like, we call it autonomy, don't we?
Yeah, and I guess this sort of comes right round to the start of the conversation, which I guess should have been at the end, around thinking about the end-of-life choice bill. And, you know, you made such a good point before about Do we trust within the medical system? And yeah, I think that's a very good point for people to think about, because when you're very sick, you are vulnerable. You are very, very vulnerable. I mean, I think about even in the first, you know, when the bomb is dropped that you have cancer, I mean, it's incredibly overwhelming. And then going through a treatment process, you go through all sorts. I mean, it's like nothing I've ever experienced. And so do we trust in our health system enough to provide the health care or the care that would be needed to guide someone through that choice? And I think that that's what it needs to come down to.
Well, you know, it depends on your life experience of the healthcare system. And, you know, yeah. I'm measuring the results that we got, and there's a lot of inequity. And, you know, I'm just telling you, I think that actually Māori will be badly served by it, because, yeah. you know, the health professionals will find a easier way of giving you the sense of, yeah, you know, this could turn out, ooh, this could be ugly, this could get messy. This is a really tough one, you know. There's an easier choice over here, you know. It's up to you, you know. If you ask for this one, then, you know, it's all, you know what I'm saying? We're not all bastards, but you know what? There's a whole lot of shit that goes on in our system right now which shouldn't be going on. No. And we're gonna give them another tool in that basket. Instead of giving some tools over here which is going to improve and deliver more and do better, we're giving them this other tool, which is just quicker.
And I think that is a concern. And it concerns, that has been what's been playing in the back of my mind. And one of our other guests basically gave the suggestion of, look at the evidence like you would if you're on a jury. Weigh it up. Can you say with beyond reasonable doubt that that this bill is going to be safe and is going to do well in all situations?
Or even the majority of situations. It doesn't have to be in all situations, you know, because, okay, I'll tell you the story. We've got institutional racism in our system, right? Mm-hmm. I'll tell you what that means. I'll make that real for you. Is Māori are not offered a prescription because a GP assumes that they will not be compliant. Māori are not offered a prescription because a GP assumes they can't afford it. Māori receive less investigations in our system. Māori receive less first specialist appointments. Māori receive less interventions, less services, and eventually less outcomes. What do we get more of in the system? We get more harms. Mm. That's what we get more of. And guess what? We're just adding another tool over there on the harmful side. Well, okay, maybe it's not harmful, but it could be harmful. And I'm just saying, given the rest of the history, given the rest of the truth around institutional racism, seriously, we're going to give them power to do that one? Oh, man, please don't. Hey, this is a beautiful paper that got published by Scott Metcalf and I think George Lake and a few other people. It was based on data from 2003. It was updated. It takes a long time to get all the prescription data. So it was published, I think, in 2013. And then in 2019, they published an update on it, which showed that nothing had changed. But this paper is famously known as the million missing scripts. Okay, there's a million missing prescriptions for Māori in this country. And the missing scripts, the number one area of missing scripts is in cardiovascular disease medicines. And then you go, I see, I can read your body language on the podcast, Helen. You went, what? Seriously? Yes, seriously. And then you understand the contribution that the health system makes to inequity. We die younger from cardiovascular disease. Mm. And one of the contributions of that is we get less scripts. We get less prescriptions. Mm, that's not good.
No. Oh, so fucked up.
Yep.
Oh, my God.
We got work to do, right?
Yeah. Yeah, we do. We really, really do. And I guess, you know, I did ask a big question and I got the big answers, but I just want to be able to open these things up, and just if they're uncomfortable for people, they're uncomfortable. We need to sit with that, you know.
So for Māori, in terms of improved health outcomes, it ain't the big expensive rare drug shit. That ain't our future. Our future is in getting our right to be serviced by a system with really cheap medicines.
Yeah.
You know, really, really cheap medicines. We've got to make sure that Māori are getting access to those. And you're going, hang on a minute, how's that even an access problem? Because, like, they are really cheap. That's like...
Really cheap. It's like $5.
Okay, well, then we added on a cost called $5 per prescription. Why did we do that?
Yeah.
Why did we add a barrier to access... Yeah. Simple medications that can improve outcomes for people. That's fucked up. We shouldn't have done that.
It is. It really is. Because
Where's the policies on that? You've been studying all the political parties, Helen. Which political party has a policy that says we will remove barriers to access, we will reduce the prescription fee? Who's saying that?
That's not going to win an election, though, is it?
It's not out there in the election, no.
No, you're right. That's not what wins elections. Thanks so much for listening. I really enjoyed making this episode because it has challenged me and helped me question some of the ingrained ideas I have. We were never going to solve an issue as complex as decolonization in one conversation. There needs to be a huge shift in perspective if we are truly going to address inequality in New Zealand. But it is so important that we have these conversations, that Pākehā listen, feel uncomfortable, and are open to learning. And as you start casting your vote in this year's election and figure out how you want to vote in the referendum, remember that you don't have to agree with euthanasia to vote yes. And equally, you can support euthanasia and vote no. It comes down to whether you think that the bill is the best bill for New Zealanders. And it's the same for cannabis. Voting yes doesn't mean that you're all of a sudden going to start buying weed. And it's actually really who is impacted by our current laws, and we need to think about those things. If you want to hear more of this sort of conversation and all sorts of other cancery talk, head over to our Spotify page. There are more episodes about both of our referendum, and you can catch up on all of our other episodes. We air every Sunday at 11:55 a.m. on Auckland's 104.6 Planet FM and anytime at planetaudio.org.nz/thecword. Thank you so much to my amazing guest, Dr. Rawiri McCree-Jensen, and thank you for listening. See you next time.
Yo traigo para ti algo excitante, mi jarabe te levanta de la tumba, es un jaleo pa' que siempre estés adelante, un poquito de mela, sazón y rumba, es un pasito que te voy a enseñar, un menejito que sé que te gustará, y cuando aprendas a bailarlo con sabor, te aseguro que este ritmo gozará. Que me gusta más, se baila así, oye, de aquí para allá. vacilar. Es que me enseña tropical, rico, y que se puede vacilar. Es que me enseña tropical, rico, y que se puede vacilar. Es que me enseña tropical, de Puerto Rico, y que se puede vacilar.
it's legit. You know it's a hit when the Neptune's on the doggy dog finna spit. You know he's in tune with the season. Come here, baby, tell me why you leaving. Tell me if this weed that you need, if you want to breathe. I got the best weed by the seas. Ain't nobody tripping, VIP they can't get in. If something go wrong, then you know we get the gripping.
Don't fuck with me. Why you telling me this is a sign? She's looking in my eyes, losing to other guys. Why you telling me this is a sign?
Don't think about it before we leave her alone. Nigga, you ain't no chick. She likes my tone, my cologne, and the way I roll. You ain't no chick.
Now you step in with a chick from Los Angeles, where the helicopters got cameras, just to get a glimpse of our chucks and our khakis and our bouncing car. You with your friend, right?
Yeah.
She ain't trying to bring over no men, right?
No.
She ain't gotta be in the distance. She can get high all in an instant.
Don't fuck, I see you, but don't fuck with me. Why you telling me this is a sign? She's looking in my eyes, losing to other guys. Why you telling me this is a sign?
Oh. Don't think about it before we leave her alone. Nigga, you ain't no change. She likes my tone, my cologne, and the way I roll. You ain't no change. Mommy, mamacita, have you ever flown on G5 from London to a Ibiza? You gotta have cake till you'll have Sundays with your key times. You'll see Venus and Serena in the Wimbledon arena. And I can
Charlie, you free. Chicken dumb, you got me foolish. Don't know what you're doing. You don't know what you lost until she's gone. She had a pretty face, drove you wild, but you ain't had that Snoop Doggy Dogg style.
I'm not sure what I see. You don't fuck with me. Why you telling me this is a sign? She's looking in my eyes, losing to other guys. Why you telling me this is a sign?
Nigga, you ain't no change. She likes my tone, my cologne, and the way I roll.
Hey.
You ain't no change.
Never miss your favourite shows again. Click onto planetaudio.org.nz.
E mohi ana koe ki te kōrero Māori. Taringa is a bilingual program produced by Te Wānanga o Aotearoa, exploring a range of concepts in English and Te Reo Māori. You can hear Taringa on 104.6 Planet FM every Friday at 3:50 p.m. And to catch up on more episodes or to find out more about the program, visit Te Wānanga o Aotearoa website.